As a real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Their teams apply local insights and global perspectives to help identify the most compelling investing opportunities. Principal Asset Management, actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors LLC. Hey there, it's Joe Weisenthal.
And Tracy Alloway.
And we are the co-hosts of the Odd Lots podcast. And we want to tell you about a new podcast here at Bloomberg we're really excited about. Money Stuff, the podcast.
That's right. Friend of the pod, Matt Levine, is teaming up with our other friend and Bloomberg TV host, Katie Greifeld, to bring the Money Stuff newsletter to life. Every Friday, Matt and Katie will dive into all the Wall Street finance and other things that make Matt's newsletter such a hit.
You can listen to Money Stuff, the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Joe Weisenthal.
Joe, I feel like it's pretty hard to be an investment manager at the moment. Like, I feel like it's hard at the best of times, but at the moment you have this intense volatility. So stuff that is normally volatile, like stocks and commodities, is even more volatile. And then you have stuff that isn't really supposed to be volatile, but definitely is in the new environment. And I'm thinking mostly about bonds.
Well, and also, you know, the underlying macro situation is just extremely complicated and contested. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, there's a debate about whether, you know, the last two quarters are characterized as a recession. And there's kind of legit questions about that in my, you know, setting aside NBR versus two quarters. Like, how should you call this environment in which consumer sentiment is really low, growth is down, employment is booming, inflation is still hot, consumption is still high? Like, these are just like really difficult environments to understand, in part because it is kind of unprecedented.
Yeah. And it seems like everyone kind of feels bad, and all the survey-based economic measures suggest that sentiment is deteriorating. But at the same time, the hard numbers are really resilient. So actual spending and investment just keep going. And yeah, you're right. It's a really weird environment, particularly if you're trying to put money to work.
And then I would say over the last 2 years, like, everyone kind of got it wrong at every turn, right? Like, everyone said, okay, COVID hit in early 2020. Here comes a big downturn and a recession. And it's like, actually, we had the shortest recession in history. And then stocks were at all-time highs a few months later. Then, you know, fast forward a little bit to 2021, people are super positive. Yeah, inflation was ticking up, but hey, it's likely transitory. It's like reopening. And almost everyone got that wrong, particularly a lot of investors, judging by the how fast the repricing happened. The Fed had to pivot pretty quickly when it realized inflation would persist for longer than expected. Pivot really started in November. So it's like, at no point has it felt like the consensus has been like, had a good feel on this cycle.
At no point has it felt like anyone really knows what's going on.
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. On that note, we are going to be speaking with someone about all of these very, very big topics, really the perfect guest. We're going to be speaking with Dan Iveson. He is, of course, the Group Chief Investment Officer and Managing Director over at PIMCO's Newport Beach. For those that don't know PIMCO, I mean, you must know PIMCO, but PIMCO has something like $2 trillion worth of assets under management. So making these tough decisions about the macro outlook and where to actually invest every day. So, Dan, thank you so much for coming on Odd Lots.
Well, thank you, Tracy and Joe. Very excited to be here today.
So you sit on PIMCO's investment committee. I'm really curious what's top of mind for the people who have to do something with $2 trillion worth of assets every day. You know, what are you guys talking about, and what's on the top of the agenda for you at the moment?
Sure. Well, you know, inflation is certainly a topic. As you mentioned, this has been an incredibly challenging time from a economic forecasting perspective. First, a global pandemic, then an unprecedented amount of fiscal stimulus, and now an inflation problem that at least is partially related to those two prior points. So, you know, increasingly we're spending a lot of time talking about this inflation dynamic, of course, how policymakers are going to, you know, look to you know, get inflation back towards their targets. And now increasingly markets are seeing, you know, what has, you know, historically been a fairly obvious trade-off, and that's, you know, growth, employment, and this inflation problem, and how will that be balanced over time. In addition to that, of course, we're not, you know, operating in a normal environment. We have war in Europe, lots of uncertainty and ongoing global tension between the United States, you know, other Western countries, and China. So there's just a lot of uncertainty, a lot of risk, and we're trying to gain sufficiently broad perspectives to see where we may have an edge. And I think it's important in an environment as highly uncertain as this one to realize when, you know, at a particular point in time, you don't have an edge, and where you're entering markets that represent a lot of risk, a lot of volatility. And I think there's a risk management piece here as well. There's enough volatility where we should be able to zero in on areas where we do have an edge and where we can add value, while looking to shelter the portfolio from a lot of the unwanted volatility that we're seeing elsewhere in markets. So that's one key theme. The second, of course, is a lot of real-time discussions around this volatility that we've witnessed beneath the surface. Mm-hmm. A lot of dispersion across equity markets and fixed income markets. A lot of, you know, localized overshooting, given markets aren't super liquid. They don't feel distressed, but certainly a type of environment where there's, you know, using a baseball analogy, a lot of singles, to hit. While you got to be careful, you know, swinging for a home run, given this radical uncertainty and the fact that you can get, you know, caught off sides pretty quickly in this type of market.
So why don't you talk a little bit more about, you know, you said identifying your own sources of edge. Like, what are they? You know, and I want to get to the actual, like, market environment and your outlook for inflation and bonds and all that. But when you think about, like, where sources of edge come from in an environment like this, like, what's the answer to that?
Well, I think one relates to you know, markets that are less liquid than they've been in the past, and opportunities to take advantage of some overshooting. Perhaps a good example is more recently over the last few weeks, or maybe going back several weeks, where equities were quite weak. Credit spreads were widening, and widening fairly significantly. Big upticks in the various volatility markets. You know, a volatility market could be an agency mortgage, but it could also be, you know, more technical, you know, volatility markets. And, you know, we've seen even over the course of this summer, various levered players, you know, other you know, specialty type styles get a bit over their skis from a risk perspective. And I think part of the snapback that we witnessed over the last several weeks, and, you know, a pretty powerful recovery into what appeared to be, you know, bad fundamental news is tied to, you know, a little bit of this this positioning that was a bit offsides.
So you mentioned how unusual the economic environment has been, and I feel like this is the source of tensions or problems for a lot of investors at the moment. Like, we're used to thinking about a normal economic cycle. You know, it starts and then at some point it stops. But it feels like what we've seen post-pandemic is not a normal economic cycle at all. How would you characterize it? Like, how are you thinking about it? Is this late cycle? Is it early cycle? It seems very confusing at the moment.
Is it a cycle outside the cycle?
Yeah. Is it even a cycle? Who knows?
Yeah, I think there are multiple cycles, or at least significant cross currents. I think when you look at cycles, I think it's important to make the distinction between a lot of the Western economies and what's going on in China right now. You know, to a lot of us, COVID is mostly behind us, and we're in the midst of a pretty significant COVID-related reopening process. Very strong demand for travel services, shift away in many economies from COVID-related goods consumption towards, you know, a more normalized you know, focus on areas associated with a more traditional and open economy. Over in China now, they're dealing with COVID. Other Asian countries are to a lesser degree. And they're in the midst of an environment, you know, where economic growth is slow and slowing, and inflation isn't a material problem. And then back to, you know, even the U.S. economy, very, very different or difficult to understand in the sense that we do have significant momentum in a lot of sectors, yet we're quickly beginning to see the impact of prior policy tightening on some key areas of the economy as well. So, you know, the level of complexity is there. But again, you know, when you have an inflation problem and you have policymakers looking to tighten policy, you're going to get into a situation where it's almost certain that you're going to see some economic weakness. And then, of course, the challenge then becomes, you know, how does this economic weakness impact inflation? Is there a chance of a soft landing? Or do we have a situation where probabilities are growing and growing fairly rapidly that we end up in a recessionary environment? Of course, those different scenarios have very different implications on what segments of the opportunity set are going to perform well, both in absolute and in relative terms.
Well, let's just get right into that. And of course, there's an econ debate. You have folks like Larry Summers and Olivier Blanchard saying, like, look, it is unrealistic. It's wishful thinking to say that we can really get inflation back down to any reasonable level without having a meaningful rise, a significant rise in the unemployment rate. Do you buy that, or do you think, because I think this is the multi-trillion dollar question right now, can the Fed get back to target without a painful recession?
Yeah, so I think history is on their side.
Who's there?
You don't see Summers, a lot of periods, Summers and Blanchard, yeah, for sure. But there's certainly a chance that we see what will feel like a somewhat soft landing. Now, you know, here at PIMCO, we still think core CPI at the end of this year is going to remain elevated up near that 5.5% type range, even out, you know, towards the end of 23. And I'd, you know, take that forecast with a grain of salt, given extreme uncertainty. But we don't see inflation getting back below 3.5%, you know, all the way out to 2023. So we do think that the likelihood is the Fed's going to need to tighten and tighten fairly significantly from here. But we do think there's at least a shot of a somewhat soft landing. We think, you know, officially, you know, we're going to have a recession. It could be a prolonged but fairly mild recession. But again, one of the bright spots, if there is a bright spot here, is that, you know, over the last few cycles, there appears to be a strong and increasingly strong relationship between the financial economy and the real economy. And you've already seen, in response to, you know, moderate tightening thus far, a pretty significant impact on financial conditions. Now, they've loosened over the course of the last several weeks, but that transmission mechanism appears to be working and working fairly quickly. So again, we have an economy with very strong momentum, particularly on the wage and the employment side. And a Fed and other central banks that have tightened, and it appears that they are having an impact on recent economic activity. So there is a path that I would define as a moderate slowdown, and a slowdown that doesn't have a material impact on overall credit fundamentals, and would probably put a 25 or 30% type probability to that type of scenario. Again, you know, anytime you have headline inflation up in the 9% type range, unprecedented, at least for, you know, several decades, and a lot of geopolitical risk, including war in Europe, which could deteriorate very, very quickly, you have to position yourself, you know, for at least a meaningful probability of a more material economic slowdown. And what that means, of course, under that state of the world, you have a lot more widening to go across most credit sectors. You probably have significant earnings deterioration from this point forward, which will likely lead to weakness in equity markets as well. So, you know, again, you know, our general view is that we have a fairly mild but sustained recession. That's why we continue to be fairly cautious regarding the more credit sensitive sectors of the market. But again, that's one of a handful of credible scenarios. And again, you have to prepare for the worst as an investor. And that means, you know, thinking about preserving capital, given the radical uncertainty, as much as it does, you know, aggressively positioning to, you know, generate total return, particularly in those riskier segments of the market.
As a leading real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Our experienced teams are uniquely positioned to uncover compelling opportunities in today's market, giving our clients an exclusive advantage. Principal Asset Management, actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors, LLC.
Hey there, it's Joe Weisenthal.
And Tracy Alloway.
And we are the co-hosts of the Odd Lots podcast. And we want to tell you about a new podcast here at Bloomberg we're really excited about. Money Stuff, the podcast.
That's right. Friend of the pod, Matt Levine, is teaming up with our other friend and Bloomberg TV host, Katie Greifeld, to bring the Money Stuff newsletter to life. Every Friday, Matt and Katie will dive into all the Wall Street finance and other things that make Matt's newsletter such a hit.
You can listen to Money Stuff, the podcast, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, Joe mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that a lot of people got it wrong on inflation. And I'm not just talking about the Fed, of course, which, you know, doubled down on the transitory idea a number of times. But I'm thinking also just of the broader market. You know, you look at break evens and those were continuously expecting inflation to peak within a few months. And that hasn't really come to pass. What do you think people got wrong about the inflation outlook? What was it that the market seemed to miss?
Yeah, I think a lot of participants, were looking at an inflationary process in a more traditional sense. I think the pandemic itself was quite confusing. It, of course, had direct supply side impacts on the global economy. And even more importantly, the policy response on the fiscal side was massive. And massive, sufficiently massive that, again, we haven't had a lot of good case studies in history in dealing with such a significant demand-side boost at a time where you already had significant COVID-related supply constraints. So, it's an unprecedented situation. We talked earlier about, these cross-currents, impacting economies, making it even harder to forecast. And I think, in some sense, we all or many of us were using prior frameworks, at least initially, to think about and to forecast this inflationary process. Now, your point's a good one. Even market pricing didn't envision this level of inflation or how sustained this inflation would be. But at the same time, when you look today at longer term measures of inflationary risk within markets, they too are fairly complacent. And if markets prove to be right, then in fact, this inflationary event may prove to be fairly temporary. So it is remarkable if you said, inflation would be, up at 9%, people would be talking about a Fed, well behind the curve, and you would have a 10-year break-even inflation rate below 2.5%, or looking at a popular rate we look at, a forward rate, like a five-year rate, well below 2.5%. Or yield curve for that matter today that is fairly flat or slightly inverted at levels below 3%. So, in some sense, although policymakers and investors were late, you wouldn't have made a tremendous amount of money through a significant bet on inflation unless you happen to be in some of those commodity markets, and particularly the commodity markets that have been impacted as much by the conflict in Ukraine as they were, tied to this inflationary trend that we've been discussing. So again, markets still may be wrong. There's still plenty of uncertainty around this inflation dynamic on a go-forward basis. But it is quite interesting that although people were late, markets are suggesting that perhaps things can be just fine with a bit more policy tightening.
Yeah, some of these medium-term break-even measures or five-year forward break-evens never really got too out of hand and are kind of in normal range. That being said, the other phenomenon this year is, I don't want to say the Fed's been behind the curve per se, because that's a little bit of a cliche and I'm never even totally sure what it means. But I would say that it does seem as though at each meeting, they're sort of expressing some hope or optimism that, okay, we think we're getting closer to where we're in a neutral range. We're not going to go as hard. And then some other data point comes out and it's like, whoops, time to increase, time to go faster again. And so we got that 75, maybe there was hope it was going to go down, another 75. Still, we're sort of, then Powell believes that policy is close to neutral. Are we at a place where maybe the Fed is in a comfortable spot? Or do you think, as you said, you think there's going to still be significant tightening from here, that once again, the Fed might have to go a little harder than it hopes, in the short term at least, in order to constrain inflation?
Yeah, you know, first of all, you know, policymakers tend to, they'll tend to have an optimistic spin on things. Yeah. But, you know, certainly the price action of late suggests that what central banks have done so far are beginning to have an impact on economic growth. And it's not a view that a hard landing is around the corner. Credit spreads tightened over 100 basis points, using high yield as a proxy. We've seen a significant, bounce in equity valuations in the midst of moderate deterioration in a lot of the forward economic indicators. So relative to where we were several weeks ago, the Fed has to be reasonably pleased with the impact of their policy decisions thus far. And I think although Powell may have slipped up a touch in suggesting, with a high degree of confidence that we're, or an implied degree of confidence that we're near neutral right now, I think the key point was that we can begin to focus a bit more on the data. You have seen the beginning of some, material signs of economic slowing in a world with massive uncertainty of a geopolitical variety or a traditional economic variety. So I think they're comfortable in the sense that they've gotten to a point where they seem to have calmed markets over the short term. This can change very, very quickly. And when we look at, a 9% headline inflation rate, which is likely at least the near-term peak, they have a lot of work to do. And we do think that they likely will need to tighten a bit more than what's currently embedded in the front end of yield curves. We don't think they were wildly far away. We still, have thought that, a 3.5% or 4% type funds rate combined with a material balance sheet reduction will likely be enough to slow the economy and get inflation back towards their target.
And we're at 250 now, so another 150 basis points of tightening, more or less, is what you see.
That would be right, yeah, 125, 150. But, again, even under that base case scenario, we're not back to core CPI levels that, within most central bank target zones until, probably out into 2024. And there can be a lot of shocks in the interim. Some that may be helpful to getting inflation back down towards target, several events that may not be helpful. And again, I think humility's got to be the key point here. When we think about inflation's impact on the developed markets, you have to be a meteorologist as well. You're going to go into a period, in Europe in particular, temperatures get cold with massive uncertainty around energy supplies and with Russia holding the cards, at least for the time being. So there are a lot of events that can derail the more positive scenarios that we've described and have been embedded in market pricing. Again, one of the reasons when we add up all of these sources of uncertainty, we see the type of rally that we've gotten across financial markets over the last several weeks, and we're inclined to take a few chips off the table, get away or reduce exposure to the most economically sensitive areas of the market. Not because our base case view is so dire. It's just that this extreme uncertainty is such that investors should just be careful in some of those more credit sensitive investments where, essentially they're forms of a short volatility type trade. And given that extreme uncertainty, we just don't think, you're getting paid enough just yet at these levels to be, overly aggressive in those more economically sensitive areas or higher yielding areas of the opportunity set. It's a generalization. There's certainly, things you can do, on the margin, but that's our general thinking, given where we are today.
Can you talk a little bit more about how you see the credit market at the moment? Because I feel like, obviously, whenever there's concern about a recession, a lot of those worries are going to seep into corporate bonds, which are economically sensitive, as you mentioned. But then secondly, even before the pandemic, I think there was quite a lot of concern about froth in various portions of the credit market, things being overvalued and potentially illiquid when the time came to sell. So how are you viewing that space at the moment? Where are there opportunities and what's most vulnerable?
Sure. So, just at a very high level, and I think there's a lot of interesting things going on, within the credit markets. We were adding some credit, back, several weeks ago when, high yield corporate bond spreads, had gotten out to north of, 600 basis points. We thought there, looking at historical analysis and thinking about embedded
our recession probabilities in those spreads, the credit markets were forecasting a very high probability of at least a moderate recession. After the rally, now over the course of the last several weeks, spreads look less interesting to us. The embedded probability in credit spreads currently of a more moderate recession has dropped, down towards, somewhere in that 20-25%, type area. So a little bit less interesting today. But back in terms of thinking about the credit market and the structure of the credit market, a few thoughts here. One, since the global financial crisis, you've had massive regulation impacting the real estate areas of the credit markets, asset-backed markets. The financial sector, as we know, is heavily regulated today. Not coincidentally, these are all the areas that caused all the problems during the GFC. Non-financial corporate credit growth in terms of issuance has been significant, both public and private markets. And that's where, before COVID, we did see a meaningful deterioration in underwriting standards. More corporate leverage, more aggressive rating agency frameworks around, putting their ratings on certain types of risk. Far fewer covenants, and when there were covenants, not particularly strong covenants. We also saw a significant build-out or growth in the private markets, which are inherently lower quality lending markets. So this is where we think there's the weak link this time if we were to get into a broad economic slowdown. Public markets have repriced, and they've repriced quite significantly in certain sectors and segments of the market. Private credit markets that always move a lot more slowly have lagged and lagged considerably. That dynamic is true within the real estate credit markets as well. If you look at what type of spread you can obtain for like risk in a public CMBS security versus where lending is going on currently in the private space. So I think point number one, it's the corporate credit sectors where there's the most excess. It's nowhere near the type of excess we saw in the mortgage credit markets leading up to the global financial crisis, so don't want to sound overly alarming. But this is probably the weakest link in the credit chain and where there will be some interesting opportunities for fresh balance sheets, fresh mandates to take advantage of what will likely be a moderate default cycle over the course of the next few years. And then again, if you have a public mandate that's repriced quite significantly versus other private markets, it makes sense to take advantage of those opportunities because over time, there's going to need to be convergence. It can converge with public markets recovering. More likely, it will converge by gradual deterioration in marks and a widening of spread levels in the private sector as well. And then the last point I'll make, all those areas I mentioned earlier that have been heavily regulated since the global financial crisis, we think present tremendous opportunity for investors. People still get nervous today about housing-related risk. Banks continue to trade in a very volatile fashion, but they are well-capitalized, and the mortgage credit market is near pristine in terms of the borrower qualifications necessary to get a loan over the last decade or so. So those are some high-level thoughts, and again, consistent with the way we're positioned across portfolios. Of course, there's a difference when we're operating in mutual fund space versus longer locked up alternative vehicles, but those same general principles are the principles we're adhering to at this stage in the economic cycle.
So my next question is completely out of self-interest, but I bought a house in February of this year. Did I top tick the market? And then secondly, you mentioned taking on some housing exposure or real estate exposure, and I'm curious what the opportunity is there exactly, because we have seen a lot of people worry about the fact that house prices shot up post-pandemic. Secondly, the fact that mortgage rates have shot up. And then thirdly, there's been some sort of market structure weirdness within the arena of mortgage-backed securities, where things, for a while, it looked like the market was sort of like creaking a little bit at the edges as rates went up very, very quickly. So how are you balancing that? Can you just dig into housing a little bit more for us?
Sure. So you may have top-ticked the market. If you send all the details to our mortgage team, we'll run some numbers and let you know just how much you top-ticked it by. But
that's a good service. Offering that service, that's a really nice service, Tracy. You got to take them up on that.
Yeah, I might too. Tell me how wrong I was. Yeah.
It is a little frightening how much mortgage data of a highly granular fashion is out there nowadays. But no, in terms of housing, so we do think housing is going to slow and slow significantly. We think on a national basis, housing is likely to decline in real terms or inflation-adjusted terms over the course of the next few years. Our base case view is that home prices stabilize near zero growth or, you know, very, very low single-digit type growth rates. But it would not be surprising, and it wouldn't necessarily have to be overly alarming if you see home prices decline on a national basis. Now, similar to the comments I made earlier, you know, the complicated, you know, economic environment, housing markets are complicated as well. As we know, there's been a massive shift in preferences since the COVID pandemic, a desire to live further from the office. Certain vacation and resort communities have gone up in price quite significantly. In some areas, there's more land scarcity than others. So there are going to be pockets where you saw a big increase in demand, where they're going to be outright price declines. You're going to hear over the course of the next several months, you know, more headlines around price reductions, price declines, a lot of stories in that regard. And I think if you're underwriting a new pool of mortgages, particularly higher risk type investments, you have to be very, very granular and very, very careful in how you underwrite that risk. But from a macro perspective, there's still too few homes in this country and other Western nations relative to the number of households that have been formed over the last several years. So again, that supply-demand dynamic is important. Rents remain elevated. So when you think about the buy-to-rent decision, although the cost to own a home has gone up, rental rates are going up as well. So that switch is less obvious. And then when you step back and look at price-to-incomes, price-to-rents, the amount of borrower equity that exists. And again, you have a tremendous amount of borrower equity today after several years of significant home price growth. And I mentioned earlier, a near pristine mortgage market from a credit quality perspective. We just don't see a major risk of significant declines in housing on a national level. We do expect, though, and you're already seeing this, a rise in inventories, a reduction in housing-related activity, which is the transmission mechanism or one of the transmission mechanisms that's going to help slow the economy and eventually bring inflation back down towards more reasonable levels. Then last but not least, from an investment perspective in housing-related areas of the market, those investments, in many cases, aren't tied to what goes on in home prices from here because they've delivered so much. So the typical housing-related investment you can buy today is backed by pools of mortgages that were issued, again, 10 or 15 years ago. Embedded loan-to-value ratios in those types of investments today have fallen from 120% back during the global financial crisis down to 40% in most cases today. A borrower with 60 points of equity in their property, even, you know, facing moderate declines in their current home price, are not a big default risk. And even if they are, that's the type of loan where you'd anticipate a full recovery. So a lot of what we like in the market today is season type risk that benefits from the multi-years of home price appreciation and therefore is much less sensitive to what goes on from this point forward.
As a leading real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Our experienced teams are uniquely positioned to uncover compelling opportunities in today's market, giving our clients an exclusive advantage. Principal Asset Management actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors, LLC.
Hey there, it's Joe Weisenthal.
And Tracy Alloway.
And we are the co-hosts of the Odd Lots podcast. And we want to tell you about a new podcast here at Bloomberg we're really excited about. Money Stuff, the podcast.
That's right. Friend of the pod, Matt Levine, is teaming up with our other friend and Bloomberg TV host, Katie Greifeld, to bring the Money Stuff newsletter to life. Every Friday, Matt and Katie will dive into all the Wall Street finance and other things that make Matt's newsletter such a hit.
You can listen to Money Stuff the Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Let me go to the other side of things. I mean, just trying to think of your overall view. It seems like not particularly pessimistic. Your outlook isn't particularly dire, but clearly risks abound and opportunities to derail a return to a soft landing. All kinds of risks out there. I'm curious, though, like, what is your view right now on if and what role Treasury should have in people's portfolio? Because I've asked versions of this question to many people. It's like for years, it was just such a great trade to own a slug of 10-year treasuries, and they went up in the principal appreciated in value. They were a great diversifier to risk assets. They usually went up when the stock market went down in the short term. And now those conditions are obviously changing to some extent. 60-40 type portfolios got clubbed. That coupon that you're getting each year is getting swallowed up big time by inflation. Is there a role what is the role for treasury ownership?
Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, you know, what you're getting at is a correlation argument. You know, are we going to have, are we going to get back to...
Yeah, can we get back there?
You know, to a degree. And I think you're witnessing this now with the recent rally that we've seen in government bond markets. Elevated geopolitical risk, you know, both in Europe and in the China situation, signs of a deteriorating economy and elevated risks of recession. And now government bonds are beginning to rally, you know, on that type of news. Now, you know, we think you get better protection, you know, up when a 10-year treasury is at 3.5% versus, you know, closer to 2.5%. But we do still think high quality bonds at these higher yield levels will provide some insurance benefit. Now, locally, and by locally, I mean, you know, during, you know, small moves in markets, we don't think, you know, you're going to, you know, we think correlation is going to be much lower than they've been in the past. I think that's going to be the case as long as inflation remains a key risk facing financial markets. But if inflation begins to trend lower up towards central bank ranges, so again, exiting this post-COVID period of elevated inflation, we do think you could revert back to more traditional correlations, and high quality bonds can, you know, provide stronger protections or stronger diversifying benefits for a multi-asset type portfolio. But for the time being, and by the time being, I mean the next several quarters, those correlations are going to be highly unstable. We think in extreme flight to quality situations, signs of a major hard landing in the global economy, signs of, you know, deteriorating a deteriorating situation with the war in Europe or a heightened conflict, you know, with China as another example. We think those are scenarios that likely lead to lower treasury yields. So the bottom line is we wouldn't give up on bonds here. I think investors just need to understand that those traditional relationships that were fairly strong have weakened. And there's just more uncertainty, at least over the short term, in terms of these overall trading relationships.
How are you hedging volatility nowadays? And who is selling it? Because it feels like everyone wants volatility protection. And I can remember, you know, once upon a time, not so long ago, PIMCO was a big seller of vol protection. But I'm assuming you guys aren't doing much of that now.
We sell a little bit of volatility explicitly. We didn't talk about agency mortgages. These are interesting investments. They benefit from a direct government guarantee or a strong agency guarantee, which is always nice, you know, given heightened risk of a more material economic slowdown. And they've widened in spread a lot. They're not quite as cheap as they were in the first quarter of 2020, but they are quite attractive on an option-adjusted spread basis relative to where they've been historically. So we have been adding back some agency mortgage-backed securities, and an agency mortgage-backed security, you know, represents a form of a volatility sale. We've also, on a targeted basis, have taken advantage of some volatility sales in the option markets. That's one of the areas I mentioned earlier where, you know, a lot of the hedge funds, other specialist managers have been caught offside given the significant moves in realized volatility. And there has been a few opportunities to provide liquidity and take on some of that risk at what we think are attractive levels.
But the way that we're dealing with volatility or uncertainty now is really staying up in quality in terms of our investments. And, you know, I mentioned that we've been reluctant to aggressively add to the weaker areas of the credit markets where you're short volatility from a more implicit perspective. So across a lot of our portfolios today, we've been taking advantage of the widening in areas of the market that represent spread risk, not material risk of permanent capital impairment. And I mentioned agency mortgages in that category. I mentioned the non-agency or the non-government guaranteed mortgages. I mentioned the banks where we have a high degree of conviction that although those spreads will remain volatile, most banks, particularly U.S. banks, a bit more isolated from the European uncertainty, are tremendously well capitalized and not taking significant risks at the moment. And then there's a whole slew of other, you know, AAA and AA type risk, high quality municipal bonds, other areas of the asset backed sectors where you have a lot of hard collateral and additional subordination. You know, these are all areas that should be resilient in a period of heightened volatility and which in some cases have widened in sympathy with these other markets that are much more sensitive to credit fundamentals.
Where are the areas that you see are particularly sensitive to credit fundamentals that you want to avoid because you don't want to deal with actual impairment?
I mentioned the private markets, right. You know, and I again, you need to differentiate there. What we're referring to there would be more traditional direct lending, mid-market companies that tend to struggle in a recessionary environment, you know, more so than right. Larger cap names. The other issues within the private markets, which have significantly lagged public markets, or the senior secured bank loan market, as an example, is that you have floating rate debt. So mm-hmm. Borrowers within that space are seeing a direct impact from Fed policy in the form of higher debt service costs. Now, some of those companies will hedge in the cap markets, but typically it's a partial hedge. Several companies won't hedge, and it's not easy to tell which companies are hedging and which ones aren't. So, you know, that's an area of the market that's going to be more sensitive to rate policy from here. In fact, we anticipate that if the Fed had to tighten policy materially more than a terminal funds rate of 3.5%, you know, you'll begin to see a decent amount of stress on that segment of the market. If that higher rate policy coincides with EBITDA or earnings deterioration, you can even see, you know, more problems from a downgrade perspective in that segment of the market. So again, I don't want to sound, you know, overly alarmist here, but in terms of looking for weaker links in the marketplace, that's where we would focus, and that's where we're being most defensive right now in terms of overall credit positioning.
So I think you've outlined a pretty sort of cautiously optimistic approach here, or maybe cautiously opportunistic, where you're sort of selecting quality credits and things like that. What would make you feel comfortable about taking on either more credit or more interest rate risk in general? Like, is there a particular thing, if you saw that happen, an economic data point or something in the market, where you would just jump right in?
Yeah, so you know, from more of a top-down perspective, better valuations as a start, you know, stating the obvious. You know, if we got up to a point where you saw some of these riskier segments of the market embed a much higher probability of an outright recession, you know, we would get more comfortable. Now, you know, that's likely up at levels, you know, around 700 basis points, you know, within the high yield space. Now, again, you think about high yield in a full-blown recession, and you get to a, you know, 1,000 basis point type spreads quite easily. But as you approach that level and you embed, you know, more risk of harder landings, you know, we would begin to add to that space a bit more aggressively. In terms of the fundamental picture, you know, really focusing on this inflationary process, we think headline is hard to forecast and is certainly going to come down based on what we're seeing in commodity prices today. But other areas represented in core CPI are going to bear watching as well. One is housing or owner's equivalent rent. It's been quite elevated. Another is wages that have been running, you know, at levels that are making central banks uncomfortable. Even related to labor, a focus on the labor force and seeing, you know, what percent of the labor force returns to the market, providing some cushion and, you know, increasing the probabilities that the Fed can bring job openings lower without a meaningful hit to unemployment. So it's really the details embedded in a lot of these higher frequency economic indicators that we're monitoring more closely. Of course, on the geopolitical side, any type of sign of a stalemate or an improvement in the relationship between Russia and Europe, the situation on the ground in Ukraine, it would take a considerable risk off the table as well. So just a lot of focus on the higher frequency type numbers. But again, even if we don't get resolution there, we are going to respond to, you know, better valuations, you know, like we did a bit, you know, several weeks ago, you know, at higher yields and materially wider spreads.
All right, Dan, we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you so much for coming on Oddlots. Really great to have you on the show. And I'll be sending over my my mortgage data to your department so you can tell me exactly how bad my timing was on real estate purchases.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, we'll do that. They have some pretty pictures, too. Yeah, they look real good.
So, Joe, I really enjoyed that conversation. There were, I mean, a number of things that stick out. Number one, the call on real estate. But secondly, when he was talking about floating rate loans and the idea of some of those companies who had borrowed money in floating rate increments, like actually becoming a credit risk as interest rates go up, that's interesting to me because you'll remember that floating rate loans were supposed to be the big hedge for higher interest rates, right? Like those were the things you were supposed to buy if inflation was going to go up and rates were going to go up. And now it's like, well, they've gone up too much and it might actually be a risk.
Right. So if you're an owner of those notes, yes, you get higher monthly coupons, which is nice in a period of higher inflation. But the cohort of companies that may have issued those
the company loans might go bankrupt
are not necessarily the most creditworthy ones, which raises the risk that if we actually get like a real recession, that your inflation hedge suddenly start to worry about loss of principal.
Exactly.
You know, just in general, I thought it was interesting, sort of, and basically to the point that you just made. You know, we tend to think very broadly about like rates and credit. But it was interesting hearing him, you know, sort of speaking from the perspective of a fixed income investor that's like, you know, credit is just way too broad a category. And so you mentioned floating rate debt, but also some of his point about like highly seasoned REITs was interesting.
Yeah.
And this idea that, again, how do you avoid credit risk? How do you get some of the upside, but avoid the credit risk in a downturn? Well, one answer might be REITs, in which the owners or the payers of those mortgages have built up significant equity such that you're not likely to experience significant defaults. These are all just sort of things that are like a little more in depth and insightful than sort of a typical like headline credit conversation.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it sounds like PIMCO, I mean, you would assume PIMCO would be very good at doing this, but it sounds like PIMCO is sort of, they're cautious in the market. They're not adding a ton of risk, but they are sort of tweaking their portfolio for the uncertainties that we just discussed.
Well, and I think also, you know, this is an environment with lots of, I don't know, landmines out there, so to speak, in which, you know, it'd be easy to, or, you know, stepping on a rake, right, and hitting your face. And so this idea that, like, you can be sort of optimistic, you think maybe the Fed, it's possible that it's turned the corner or getting ready to make a pivot, that maybe we're going to soon see lower CPI readings. We'll have some confidence that the line is going down, but there are just so many little things that could go wrong. There's politics, there's geopolitics, there's the virus, there's other aspects of the supply chain that, like, it all sort of keeps you guessing.
Actually, recording these intros and outros kind of makes me nervous nowadays because there's so much that could happen between the time that we record and when we release. Yeah. All right. Shall we leave it there?
Let's leave it there.
All right. This has been another episode of the All Thoughts podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway. You can follow me on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Joe Wiesenthal. You can follow me on Twitter at The Stalwart. Follow our producer, Carmen Rodriguez, at Carmen Armin. And check out all of our podcasts at Bloomberg, under the handle @podcasts. Thanks for listening.